Welcome to the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Turk. Join me as we dive into the personal stories of some of the world's best hospitality professionals. We follow the journey of their ups, downs, and wild turns to find out what it truly takes to make it in the amazing world of hospitality.
Here's something I've learned after years in hospitality. The best operators are incredibly intentional about how they use their time. Because when your day is filled with manual tasks like updating calendars, responding to repetitive guest messages, or managing payments, you're not focusing on leadership or growth. That's why tools like Logify exist. Logify is an all-in-one platform that helps hospitality operators manage short-term rental properties more efficiently. It keeps your calendars synced across booking platforms, automates guest communication, processes payments, and even lets you create your own direct booking website. So instead of juggling multiple systems, everything lives in one place. And what I love about that is simple. It gives you your time back, which is one of your most valuable resources in hospitality. If you want to check it out, Hospitality Mentor listeners and viewers can get 60% off of Logify's yearly and bi-yearly professional and ultimate plans with the code THM60. And that's THM60. Now, back to the episode. Welcome to another episode of the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. And today, listeners and viewers, I'm very excited. We've got Joseph Forsmeyer, the Managing Director at Roundhill Hotel and Villas, joining us today, live from Jamaica. Joseph, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be on your program. I'm very honored. Thank you.
Well, let's get right into it like we always do here. What was your very first job in hospitality?
Well, I grew up in it, I have to admit. You know, it's something that was sort of in my blood. We had to work at our parents' restaurants and when we were children and Sundays and helping out. So it's something that we grew up in with my brothers and sister. And so ultimately, it's always something I wanted to do as a profession. And my parents, you know, gave me the opportunity to put me in some good schools. So I went through hotel college in Place and Palace in Salzburg. And by being there, you know, I met it's an international school. So I was able to meet a lot of international students, fellow students, and some of them was from Jamaica as well. And so I've always sort of felt it's something I wanted to do. I wanted to get to know the Caribbean, get to know the country. And when I was finished, I opted to get international experience first. And Jamaica opened up as an opportunity. And I was offered not the job in the hotels, if you will. I was offered a job by a very successful hotel operator who had happened to have a German wife. And they had a son who had just turned 5. And they were looking for a German teacher, actually, who would speak and teach the young gentleman German. And so I thought, you know, for a couple of months, I can do that. Plus, I'm in the hotel business. I've just come out of school and you know everything better, as you know, when you come out of school. So maybe there's an opportunity for me there. And that's how I was hired to be the mentor, the teacher for a young man in the Grill, Jamaica at Hotel Coconut Cove in 1979. And I arrived there and I did that for 2 weeks. And then after the first 2 weeks, the owners of the hotel obviously realized that I was constantly correcting anything they were doing wrong in the hotel. So they said to me, Joseph, since you know everything so much better, why don't you just help us to run the hotel? And I became an assistant manager there. And from there, my career took off and I never looked back. And then three hotels later, I'm now at Roundhill. I happened to stay much longer than I anticipated, obviously. There's certainly a part of me that fell in love with Jamaica, with the island. I can't say exactly when it happened, possibly after my second experience with a hurricane, when you realize how incredibly strong and resilient the people were and how absolutely non-judgmental they were in order to allow you to be part of their process, their rebuilding, their joy and their suffering. And that sort of gave me a real passion for the island. And before you know it, you know, you have a positive attitude that we all do in this industry. I mean, you're always very sort of positive, forward-looking. And you work with what you have. I mean, you don't bemoan the facts that you don't have certain things. So you work with what you have and you make the best of it. And before you know it, I was able to really get into a wonderful career path. I left my first job 2 years later to become the general manager in a beautiful luxury, small luxury resort in Port Antonio called Trident Villas and Hotel. And after it was badly damaged by Hurricane Allen in 1980, I was offered to help to rebuild it and build it from scratch, which gave me a wonderful opportunity to do something that I've always wanted to do, thinking that I may be doing that in my 40s. But now I was in my early 20s. And so I actually lived a very fast life in my professional development. And therefore, that sort of gave me wonderful credentials and learn a lot about everything from hotel construction and how to navigate through difficult economic times, in because Jamaica was going through some difficult economic period, so that you become very resourceful. And again, that's something that I'm very, very grateful for Jamaica to have taught me that and gave me that resilience. And then I was hired away from there to take over Roundhill and move it from it, which has been one of the great sort of resorts in the Caribbean. I've always admired it from afar. I've heard of it. I did not know it personally very well. I'd only stayed here once before with my parents in the 1980s. In 1989, I was hired to take it from a winter season only resort, one of the few that was left that actually did not operate 12 months a year, into a 12-month resort, and therefore to ensure that its infrastructure, its entire product is in keeping with the 12-month operation rather than a 3-4-month operation, and to then really make it into an all-year-round place that appeals to an international audience that is more than just sort of the repeat guests that have always kept coming here for generations for a few months in the winter. And it was a challenge on one hand, but it also was an incredible opportunity for me to rely on all my connections, apply all the things that you have learned by rebuilding hotels after hurricanes, and to make sure that all the property has the best ability to perform at a high level consistently, not just for 3-4 months of the year. Yeah. And that's always a challenge, as you can imagine, in this industry. You know, when you have a high season, which starts end of November, probably Thanksgiving, and goes until the end of Easter. And then you have the summer season, which is beautiful in Japan. Well, but so is the rest of the world. So, I mean, our demand drops off, and therefore you have to shift your audience. You have to shift, you know, who is going to be your main guest base. And we had to develop that. And we had to move from a resort that was mostly patronized by elderly people, by more mature audience, let's call it this way, into a family resort, and starting to take children, develop programs for children. And it's not that we've never taken children, because our villas are privately owned by individual shareholders, and they've always had children too. So it wasn't the question of not wanting children, but we were just not known for it. And so it became a challenge to do that. Plus, you know, you wanted to ensure that you create enough connection with groups and weddings and that you can appeal to a much broader audience that will still like you for the same things that your typical winter season audience loves you for. You.
I'm going to pause you here, because we unpacked a lot here in that first question. And you told me, so listeners and viewers, Joseph told me, he said, if he goes long, which he knows he's been known for, which he tells great stories, let's pause him, because you unpack so much. And I want to get to how you got Roundhill to where it is today. But I want to go back a little bit, because you mentioned something at the very beginning where you worked on with your parents. And I looked back, it was just something interesting to me that you worked, they had a farm and a restaurant right in a small town outside of Salzburg in Austria. How many brothers and sisters did you have there? Were they all working with you, or was it just you?
Yes, there's four of us. The oldest is my sister, and then there's three of us, three boys. I was the youngest, and we all had to, you know, had to assist on a Sunday when it was extremely busy. Every child got as part of the restaurant that they were in charge for. You know, my father was big in the hunting business, you know, and all his hunting friends came. So that was my brother. He also was in the voluntary sort of fire service, and that was in another area of the restaurant that was all the firemen used to come after church. And I was in charge of all the farming ladies, all the farmers' wives, who also would come. On a Sunday, everybody comes to church, obviously. That was the big day when the country people came into town. And then we were booming. I mean, that was just very important, that that was something that you grow up with, and that gives you, it gives you a little insight into people's psyche. It gives you, it helps you to understand guests and hospitality. And I think it was very important for us as children to be able to do that. And since I was the youngest, I obviously, you know, had more freedom than my older sibling, who had to go through various phases and break down barriers for me. But I remember I could do anything I wanted. I could party all night long on a Saturday night, as long as I was there on Sunday morning at 7 o'clock and was able to work. And it lasted until 12 o'clock and after lunch, you know, and then it was finished. And as long as you did that, no matter what you did the night before, you were perfectly fine. And I think that was a wonderful freedom, but it also was a lesson that teaches you responsibility.
Did your brothers and sisters go into hospitality as well, or was it just you?
No, I'm the only one. So no. As a matter of fact, they did what they had to do, and then they couldn't wait to get out of this and get away from it all. So, you know, it's interesting. You either love it forever, or you just have to, you say, you know, that's not going to work for me. So,
it's a lifestyle, not a job. So
absolutely.
And this is where I'm curious, right? It's one thing, you tell us how you got to Jamaica, right? But it's another thing to stay. So was your family supportive of you staying there? Did they want you to come back? What ended up happening? Because there's so many people that want to go do things and then end up back home. How did you end up in a whole different world?
My mother was always very supportive because she liked to travel. My father is very much more traditional, much more conservative. But he also encouraged all of us to sort of see the world. I mean, that was my brothers, my sister. So we were always encouraged to go and travel and see the world that we were sent. And I was sent, you know, by myself. I mean, this is incredible now looking back, but I was sent by myself to the south of France, you know, for 3 months in the summer to make sure that my French would be perfect so I could spend summer down there, you know, in a summer school. And the same thing to England. So things that you did at 15 and 16 that you wouldn't necessarily send your child to today, I mean, which is actually quite incredible. But it does provide you with a sense of responsibility, and it matures you, you know. Now the issue of, you know, him thinking that my mother had no problems with me going to Jamaica. My father said, oh, you're going to be back in no time at all. Because, you know, he always waved the little carrot, like it happens to all of us, you know. Oh, you get this house and you get this piece of land and then you come home and then you can have this one. And so we were always a little sort of tried to sort of bring you back by making you more comfortable by coming home. And Joseph just wasn't playing that game. I mean, I just didn't want to necessarily come home and do that. And so after about 6 years of me being in Jamaica, this was when he finally broke down and decided then it's time for them to come and see where I was, because they had not visited. And that's when he realized that, you know, that I was absolutely sort of in love with the island, and he could see it. I mean, my parents realized they also fell in love with Jamaica, and felt, before you know it, it was back and forth. My nieces and my nephews and everybody started to sort of jump on planes and fly back and forth. And before you know it, Jamaica became like an outpost of the little town where I grew up in. I mean, and I have a family here that then married Jamaican as well. And so there's a real good interaction now between a small town in Austria and Jamaica today.
So as I get into where you're at now, I want to tell listeners and viewers, now is a good time to pause and check out roundhill.com, because now we're going to start talking about it. I want you to see it. So if you're not driving, take a minute to check out where Joseph works, because it is unbelievable if you start going through the website and seeing what it is, because you've been there since 1989. There's not many hoteliers that stay in a location for that long and get to create something like this and continue to evolve over multiple decades. How does that set up for you, right? Because we could go through your career and talk about everything you've done there, but I'm curious about that angle. Is you've been there for so long, how does that happen when you're working with owners and a property?
As I said earlier, I mean, I was blessed to have owners that are madly in love. And when I say madly, they are passionate about Roundhill and Jamaica. And not only are they passionate, but they're also each individually bring a lot to the table. You know, be they in leaders in finance, be they leaders in society, you know, being at several sort of European high aristocracy owned homes here. And what really is very special is because not only is he a great fashion designer, he is an amazing influence when it comes to style, and he knows what feels right. Ralph knows it. Now, not just Ralph, but also his wife, Ricky. I mean, and the interesting part is Ricky actually he has an Austrian background. I mean, she's originally not a very well-known Viennese family that ended up in the United States, and then obviously they met and fell in love and married. And he is just a real kind, incredibly focused and talented gentleman that welcomed me when I came here. And when I wanted to find, because I, you know, when you come somewhere new, you want to fix everything. You want to fix everything because the place was open for 3 months. We had a year, so you had to be open 12 months. So you have to make sure that it also is more sustainable. It has its refresh, and having the resources of a Ralph Lauren and some others at the resort helped me tremendously to sort of accomplish that. And he immediately got excited about it because he also felt that Roundtable and Jamaica present something that he also fell in love with. You know, that tradition, that combination of the British style together with a very lush, colorful, tropical environment that created that look, you know, what's known as the campaign look, you know, the dark mahoganys, the white curtains, the beautiful sort of blues and pinks in nature, you know. And then we just got going on redecorating the rooms and redoing the baths and polishing the villas to make them more relevant. There always was this uniqueness about Round Hill because it sits on a peninsula surrounded by 3 sides of water and overlooking the Western Bay, so it's very protected. And therefore, it has open verandas that are fully furnished. And so our founder, a Jamaican gentleman by the name of John Pringle, always defined luxury as being able to live with indoor furnishings in an outdoor setting. Something that's very special that you cannot have anywhere else. And I mean, as you know, part of a vacation experience that is very memorable is to do things that you would never or could never do at home. So therefore, it forces you out of your natural environment into something completely new. And by doing that, you achieve an element of memory that becomes very special. And that's what Roundtable presents. And all of that, obviously, based on amazing staff, because these are people that helped John Pringle build the place. Their children are working here. Their grandchildren are now working here. So we have a team that is truly not just workers. I mean, they are people that love the place, that have a true connection to it, and that have tremendous pride in what they do. And it comes across. And many times guests tell me, Joseph, this is beautiful. We love Round Hill, but it's really the people that bring back year after year.
That's amazing. And when I look at the website, what you mentioned, Ralph Lauren, you know, I was excited to talk to you about that because he's someone I look up to, whether it's style of hotels or the dress, like I'm actually wearing a jacket of his right now, is timeless elegance is on the website. And I think that's where you think is, how does this jacket going to be handed down to my kids and down to the next generation? And it is that kind of class that really inspires me. You know, I'm building our first hotel called Baia. It's on a tropical fruit farm. And when we first started 3 years ago, before, you know, it was all getting going, I was like, all right, I want to explain to you, well, this is Ralph Lauren going camping, but glamping, and now it's elevated to a luxury kind of vibe. And so that's exactly how I used to communicate the vision to the investors. So I'm excited that you get to work with him and see it. And, you know, you have owners that have been there since 1953, I think, when the hotel opened.
Yes, yes.
So how do you continue to evolve? Because we were talking backstage, there's some historic hotels that never truly evolve and now they feel tired, but yours does not. How do you continue to do so?
I mean, many of my fellow hoteliers, be they in Jamaica, be they in the Caribbean or international, I mean, we always look across. I mean, I'm never secure. I'm always searching to do better. And who is doing something better? I'm actually, deep down, I'm an insecure individual. I mean, I want to know, could I do it better? Is there something that I should be doing differently? So you're constantly questioning yourself. So you're starting out by trying to always do things better, but then always measure it against what your core values represent. I mean, there's a core value, 3 core values we have. Time is elegant, understated luxury, warm Jamaican heart. Those are the 3 things that we all buy into. And whatever we have to do has to sort of fit into that concept. Now, I have that great honor and pleasure to have a Ralph Lauren around where I can go to and say, you know, what is it that, is there something that would fit into that? And Ralph will tell you, the man is the most self-convinced individual on the planet. He will know. He will say, Joseph, that works and that doesn't work. And if you tell him, but Mr. Loring, couldn't we do sort of instead of white floors, couldn't we do just sort of darker wood? No, he says, no, it has to be white pile and it has to feel like sand because that's what I want in my hotel rooms. That's what it was. But how do you keep it clean? Said, well, you can keep it clean. You know when it's dirty, you can just clean it, make sure, and it works. Now, when it comes to technology, I have Bob Pittman as one of my shareholders, for instance. You know, so he said, Bob, what do we do? I mean, this is one of the great sort of minds, visionary when it comes to the internet and the whole creation of AOL at the time, actually. You know, so he somebody says, you know, make it accessible, but don't expose it too much so that people still are able to maintain their own comfort zone wherever they are. So make sure you have the best Wi-Fi, you have all the ability, but don't put it in all over the place where you're getting disturbed by it, you know? So make sure it's right, relevant where you want it. So now we have technology hidden in everything, right? But it's not in your face. We don't have televisions in our hotel rooms, just to let you know. I mean, we don't. We don't want that. We don't want it to be so loud that the person next door sort of doesn't know, you know, how to turn off. So there are some real idiosyncrasies that you're constantly battling with. But I feel that I never forget one experience I once had. We had with a very well-known sort of wealthy New York socialite who could stay anywhere and said to me, Joseph, when I come around, I relax like I've never relaxed before. I said, why is that? She says, well, because there are certain things I just cannot do here that I would automatically do when I'm at home. I turn on CNN, I'm worried about the stock market. And here, it's possible if I go online, but you know what? It's not in my face constantly. And I think sometimes you need to remove your audience a little bit from their everyday tasks in order to sort of ensure that they start to relax. And you surround them with care, love, great staff, a lot of attention. And before you know it, they start to relax. I think that's part of what we do well. We don't try to be, I always said, we don't try to be in, because once you're in, you know, you can be out. But I always like to know that we provide you with the best service, with the best ambiance, with the most best care that you can hope for on your vacation. And all of that in a very understated, not sort of flashy environment, so that there's no stress there on how to behave and how to dress necessarily. But albeit, people dress well, you know. I mean, they, you know, we don't have to have a million signs around about dress code, because once you fit into Round Hill and it is what you want, you know how to behave. And that's such a good thing to know. So, you know, we don't have to have a ton of rules in order to create the ambiance. It's the guests themselves that do it. I always say it's just like if you buy an expensive ticket to go the Simplon Venice Orient Express, for instance, right? I mean, that famous train, right? I've been on it, and you dress up to the nines and black tie for dinner, you know? And then you spend the night and you have dinner and everybody sort of becomes part of the scene and plays it out. And this is exactly the same here. When you come to Round Hill, you just become part of that magic and you make an effort and everybody appreciates it.
I have a question for you, because a lot of people may be like me, and pardon my take on this, right? Of Jamaica, they have something in their mind. They don't understand the full Jamaica, right? I go on my Royal Caribbean cruise. I get off at Ocho Rios. I go see the falls. I get bombarded by people selling me things. I saw Cool Runnings when I was a kid, so I learned about the bobsled team and I listened to Bob Marley. That's my Jamaica take. What do you tell people like me when they say, oh, I've already been to Jamaica? What do you tell us?
I mean, the messages out there they're all real. I mean, whatever you just said is very true. All part of the overall experience. That's what many of our visitors experience, certainly when they come on a cruise ship, when they're not able to actually spend a few nights here and get to know the people and get to know the country a little better. And I've never been defensive about it, albeit I've always been hit with all kinds of problems that Jamaica has faced, from crime and from harassment and from, I mean, you name it. I mean, and it's hard to to deny the fact that we have problems. I mean, we are a country. We are not just a small island, and there are many beautiful small islands in the Caribbean, but we are not one of them. We are a country. We are the third largest island in the Caribbean after Cuba and Hispaniola. Jamaica is the third, and then only after us is Puerto Rico, and smaller than Jamaica. We have a very solid population base of 3 million people that live here, and another 3 million Jamaicans that live abroad. So there's a 6 million, and that's why we play much beyond our size in terms of recognition, be it in music, be it in sports, be it in whatever field. I have a saying, we're the best of whatever we do. We are the best when we are good, and we are the best when we want to be bad. So, but does it ever affect our visitors? I mean, our bad reputation does, because it makes it harder for us sometimes to promote the destination, because we are not an Anguilla, we are not St. Lucia, we're not Bubby, and we will never be, and we cannot compete with that image, because these are truly special places, but they have 250,000 people, yeah, and therefore Jamaica does not. Jamaica has volume, is loud, is passionate, full of flavor. I mean, I go hiking every Sunday at 6:30 in the morning. It's called Joseph's Hike, Sunday Hike. And all my guests are welcome to join me as long as they are there. At 6:30, you have to be in the lobby, put on your sneakers. Usually we are gone anywhere between 8 to 10 to 12 miles. We leave at 6:30. I have you back by noon. It goes into the communities. It goes into the hills and the valleys and the mountains and the flowers. You hear the church choirs singing. All the most beautiful, potentially unrecognizable sites, because no visitor ever gets there. Yes. And it's a real unique experience. And whenever we come back, many of our visitors say, "Man, my God, Joseph, I would have never seen that. Wouldn't have been for you." But I haven't done anything else but just gone into the countryside, not being in a tourist destination. But what it tells me is that because you're doing something that is normal, and where normal people live, where our communities are, and some of them may be very poor, some of them may have nice houses, but your one thinking is 100% certain. Everybody who lives in these communities lives with magnificent million-dollar views. And everybody, rich and poor, know that. And they are proud of it. And it shows when you visit these communities, you walk through them, people wave to you and they say, "Morning, morning." And you see that pride. And that is such an important part of Jamaica's brand, because they live in a beautiful place. While the living may be hard at times, you know, somehow because of where they are, it makes it all less stressful. Let's put it this way. And I admire that greatly. And, you know, having just come through a massive hurricane, I don't need to tell you, Melissa probably was one of the worst hurricanes we have ever experienced. I mean, it was a Category 5, late October 2025, and literally, you know, 4 weeks later, yes, it was a lot of destruction, but people picked up the pieces and moved about walking in these areas. You see how quickly everybody, you know, gets back into shape, and much faster than some first world countries, actually. And that shows me their strength. There's incredible love for their country, but there's also a commitment there, you know, that allows a foreigner like myself to be part of it, as long as you are respectful and you like what you do. And I find that part of my passion for the island, you know. I mean, it's that simplicity, and the people that you come across are not sophisticated, but they have a natural sort of understanding of everything. They know you, they have a sense of geography. Wherever you come from, you know, nobody will ever confuse Austria with Australia in Jamaica. I mean, they will know when you see Austria, they know that there's a Vienna and there's an Innsbruck and a Salzburg. It's funny because, you know, I went to school in America and everybody thought I'd live with kangaroos, you know, so. And I told them I was from Austria. I mean, it's funny, you know, but that's
true.
Yeah, it's part of being in a small country. You tend to be more exposed to sort of bigger world, and you learn more about it than when you're in a big country, then you are less likely to sort of.
Well, let me ask you this, because you painted a beautiful picture. I love this hike idea that you have. I think that's something really special, and I wish more leaders would do that in their communities. I think the guests would see something really unique. You put something in my brain that is really unique that maybe I take on down the road for some of our guests. But for you, you've been there since 1979. So I feel like you're definitely a local, but I guess they don't consider you a local. You're still a foreigner.
I mean, it's funny. I was telling somebody the story. I just was hiking yesterday and I was traveling for 3 weeks. So I hadn't been around. And I have about four or five different hikes in different communities, different hills, different mountaintops. And so yesterday, I mean, obviously some people haven't seen me for 3 weeks. They said, "Hi, General, where have you been?" You know, and so it's, so they called me General, you know, because some of them don't know my name. But I have a dog, a Jamaican brown dog that walks with me and that follows me. He's the most loyal animal on the planet. It's fantastic. And it was Jasper. So people know Jasper and they wave to Jasper. And it's one of those things that they do accept me. I have a Jamaican passport. I also have dual citizenship. So I'm a proud Jamaican, but ultimately, you know, I look foreign to them. I am not necessarily, mind to be a white Jamaican. So that should be that way. But I cannot speak Patois. I mean, even if I try, people break down laughing, you know, it's awesome for me. I'm emotionally, as I said, Jamaican, but many of them accept that. But I do realize that I'm not necessarily automatically accepted as such. So they view me a little bit as a stranger.
And so for a lot of listeners, I've talked to a lot of people. They last 2-3 years on an island that they work at, and they get back to, you know, where they are a bigger continent of their home country. For you, how do you work in a place for this long and have so many generations of people? And, you know, you always hear about island time and, I'll get to it. How do you run such a great place by having so many different family members and different people on your properties?
I've been in the industry for a long time, but I went into it because I wanted to see the world. And it sounds weird because the first place I went to was Jamaica and I never left. So it's hard for me to sort of compare it. I can compare it certainly to Austria, but no matter where you live, you always come across challenges, be they in time management, be they with supply lines, be they with staffing. Whatever positives you have on one hand, there's always certain challenges that come along with it. Jamaica is no different. I mean, there's many positives that make life here so much easier. And certainly the access to great staff, I mean, is one of the greatest things in our industry, because in hospitality, you have to have good people. And that is the core of any business. You can easily and quickly build something very special and put all kinds of products in order to make it wonderful. But, you know, if the hospitality aspect of it and the human resource is not available, then it becomes a challenge. I know that's what Europe is going through right now. We have a lot of labor is just not available. And you're starting to lose a lot of your core competencies because you're just not being able to hire in Austria. I mean, it's really difficult for Austrians to find Austrians to work. So you're ending up teaching people languages and the German language because you have to now hire foreigners that will become Austrian after that. But it does take away a certain element of hospitality. So my core reality is that I'm blessed with great human resources here. Everything else we can find and build. I have a strong belief that you need to give back to your community as much as possible. So therefore, we have a philosophy here to buy as local as possible, everything. I mean, from our services, be they taxi drivers, be they equipment, be they, you know, any kind of a consultancy. I don't go abroad. I go as close to my community as possible. So whatever dollars I spend outside of wages, you know, goes also back into the community so that the community benefits more from the resort. And I think that's really important because that makes your resort sort of be a driver of the economic livelihood and makes it easier for everybody to be upwardly mobile. And that ultimately helps your overall sense of security and the sense of belonging. And we have a very, very successful charity program in place since 1957. It's going to celebrate next year 70 years. It's called the Hanover Charities because our parish is the parish of Hanover. And we have an event called the Sugarcane Bowl every February then where we raise over $1 million every single year net. That's just for local programs, scholarships, scholarship programs for tertiary education, etc., to really give back to the community to make sure that our communities helped and thrive better. And the same goes for your construction business, your local contractors, your furniture makers, and your upholsterer. They're as close to where you are, even if it may cost a little bit more initially. But I think it's an investment. And ultimately, and it happened again, I saw it as a perfect example after Hurricane Melissa. Hurricane Melissa happened on the 28th of October. I had already reached out to four of our major contractors in the area. And I said, you know, stand by. The moment it's over, I need to have you here. We have to go through everywhere. We've got to see what we can do. I want to save the winter season. I do not wish to close down for months on end. I had to be open September so I can save the winter season. And you wouldn't believe it. They were there next morning. So it was all our staff that came out, and together, you know, we were able to put the place back in shape and look in as good a shape as you can possibly put it. And we were open on the 8th of December. But that's because these people and all our people in our community was committed to make sure that Round Hill gets back into business as quickly as possible.
Yeah, because you're helping support so many for so many years. It really shows. It's a good thing for a lot of listeners to hear, especially giving back to your community, being a good neighbor. It shows in times of need that they came and stepped up because you've been supporting them for so long.
And we were the only one. I mean, yes, we were somewhat spared because we are just in a blessed location. But on the other hand, we could have also been closed for months of end.
Yeah. So you have a lot going on. I'm not asking for your five-year plan or anything like that, but what are you most excited about at Round Hill in the next year?
I think my biggest effort right now is to make sure that whatever we have accomplished at Round Hill, ability to attract a real high-end value audience, be they North American, be they European, South American, and that loves us for what we are, can translate into making that happen for them. I sit on the board of the Jamaica Tourist Board. I'm a director and have been there for many years, representing the luxury segment of the market. And one of the things that I've always firmly believed is that we are the luxury of authenticity. I mean, if you know, others may be do certain things better, they may have a better image, but the one thing Jamaica has, it is incredibly authentic. And that is a luxury because nowadays we all seek experiences and experiences which are authentic. And then nobody does it better than Jamaica. Even though we may not have, you know, your Mandarin Orientals or your the Aman Resorts or the Four Seasons, I mean, I wish they would come here as well. But since you don't have that, let us just promote the fact that Jamaica has a great boutique type resort product of every size. Yes, we have a lot of all inclusives, but we also have enough of the other kind, the villas and the luxury sort of boutique type resort that we can offer luxury experience in Jamaica that is based on the enormous authenticity of the island, from its waterfalls to its mountains, to its hikes, to its beaches, to its food, to its music, to its culture, to its sporting events. I mean, you name it. I mean, it does happen here on a big scale, not just on a small island here. And that is a wonderful opportunity for guests to expose themselves to. And I'm just right now really working with the ministry and the Jamaica Tourist Board to make sure that that can be sort of blueprinted onto a bigger code where the island is viewed less as an all-inclusive destination, but more of a luxury sort of destination for the unique luxury traveler. Not necessarily the one who likes the generic luxury, but for the one that looks for authentic luxury experiences.
I think you put that really well. I think that's what people are looking for more and more now, especially with all the technology and all this AI and all the video, everything coming in. You're looking for things that are unique. It's not the same everywhere. And listen, I work for Mandarin Oriental in my career. Great brand, great hotel. I learned so much from them, but it's very different what you've created here. And I'm only seeing it from videos and pictures. I can't wait to hopefully make a visit to come go your hike now. You've convinced me just for the hike. I got to get myself in shape and ready for it. So my last question for you, Joseph. You know, we could go on and on with you, I'm sure. But my last one is, if you could whisper in young Joseph's ear at 1979, arriving in Jamaica, some advice, if he was starting out today, what advice are you giving him to start out his hospitality career?
It's funny. I mean, you know, somebody asked me that once before. I said, I do go into the schools here as well occasionally when they ask me. And then there was the question, what would you give me advice? What is the most? I know it sounds silly, you know, coming from a hotel, man. But I would say, learn as many languages as you possibly can. If there's one truth, if you want to be, you know, you can learn everything else, but learn languages. Because I tell you what that will do. The more languages you speak, the easier you will be able to travel internationally and work internationally, because it is a one core differentiator for a work permit. I mean, well, for me to get, I had to get a work permit in Jamaica when I first came. And two languages wasn't good enough. A minimum of three languages was what sort of set me ahead of others. Wow. Obviously, everybody speaks English and Spanish, one way or the other. Now, anything beyond that sort of gives you an edge. German, Italian, French, and the more languages you speak, the easier you can apply and get through on the, through the various bureaucratic processes, work permits. And that, to me, helped me for, I would say, the first 10, 15 years until I was able to establish a career and people respected me for what I did. And it wasn't such an issue anymore. But so as a core value in terms of how to get ahead, learn languages and try to speak them as fluently as possible. Try to expose yourself and live in countries so that you can perfect the language as much as possible. And it will help you in your career. In hospitality, certainly, because communication is key in everything we do. Mm-hmm. It is key in how we promote the brand, how we communicate with each other, be it on the staff level, be it with guests. And there's nothing more important than languages. And everybody likes to know that you make an effort to speak their language. So I would say that's the most important detail.
I love that advice. You are the first one to give that advice. Of all the 188 episodes, you're the first to do it, which I appreciate you doing, because I have a 10 and an 8-year-old, and I'm trying to get them now more and more into learning their second language, because I was lucky enough to have one. So you just drilled that into my mind. I'm going to be saying, hey, I talked to Joseph today. The general, he told me you got to be getting your languages ready. I appreciate that advice. And listeners, if you have not yet, now's the time to do it. Check out roundhill.com. You are going to see some amazing views. I see a bar wrapped around a tree by the beach that I'm ready to sit at when I come down there. It looks amazing. And if you haven't yet, listeners, make sure pause this, hit that share button, send it to somebody, share them with Joseph's story about Roundhill, his career. He shared a lot of great things here. And of course, if you have not yet, make sure to hit subscribe. Joseph, I'm very grateful you spent this time with me, shared these stories with me. I know how busy you are running a world-class resort.
Thank you so much, Steve. It was a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.